What years did you go to Middlebury?
What years did I have Middlebury? That's a hard question. I have no idea. I graduated in 06, 2006.
What did you study while you were at Middlebury?
I was a women's and gender studies major with a minor in psychology. Well, I was originally pre-med. I thought that's what I was going to do. And then I was like, okay, psychology seems to be my thing. And then I totally just switched in my last year and went all women's and gender studies, even though I basically had all the requirements for psychology.
How would you describe the campus culture at the time you were a student?
So I would describe it as a lot of different things, but I felt invigorated. I felt like people felt empowered to protest, empowered to have a voice, and I felt a momentum happening. Like I felt this like momentum of activism happening that I was part of and, led with a lot of my very good friends. And I felt like it was a time that at least I personally felt like I was surrounded by people who wanted systemic change and not just in the microcosm in this like fairy tale world that is Middlebury, but just, around the world. It was like a global thing. It felt like revolutionary, and it was certainly not the case for everyone. I mean, I think you can go to Middlebury and have whatever experience you want if you're super privileged and white and rich, which, there's certainly that there. You can roll with that crowd and be in a social house and do all of that kind of stuff. And then there was a really like large part of our campus that I felt very connected to, which was like a mini revolution that was happening. And I personally felt very empowered and surrounded by faculty and staff and students who rallied around issues.
You mentioned you felt like that was also happening on kind of an outside of Middlebury scale. Were there like movements or events happening in the world that you felt contributed to what you were experiencing and doing?
Well, I felt like so a lot of the stuff that we were working on, so I was president of Feminist Action at Middlebury, which had sort of a lull at some point. I'm not really sure when it started, but certainly by the time I had become like sophomore, junior, I felt like I needed to be more connected to a feminist movement, and that wasn't really there. And so me, my friends, we got together and or I got together with a bunch of friends and said like, let's revitalize Feminist Action at Middlebury. And so we did. And it was I would say there was like a larger conversation happening around sexual assault on campus, which has been an ongoing conversation, I feel like, for decades now. But we certainly were dealing with that on campus and in large numbers, and numbers where even, our president at the time, Leibowitz, and others on the administration perhaps did not see it as such a large scale issue, not realize recognizing, the ways in which sexual assault happen. And so many of my friends, I feel like so many women personally, were just being affected by it. If it wasn't them, they knew someone who had been sexually assaulted or, an attempted assault or something of that nature. And so yeah. And so that's what our main focus was. It was about like that, about loving your body. We used to do like love your body fashion shows and fundraisers and things like that. And I felt that was always a larger conversation that was ha being had in society and in the world. And so we were really just amplifying it in a space where it was sort of silenced. I mean, we were trying to get blue lights on campus for quite some time, and there had been a few, but not enough, quite frankly, for what the requirements had been, or the recommended requirements had been. And so that was an issue, and we took it on wholeheartedly and fought for blue lights to be on Middlebury's campus. And the reaction to it was We're in Middlebury, Vermont. There are beautiful stars at night, and we don't want the lights to cause light pollution for stargazers. And it's like, are you fucking kidding me? Like that's the re like really that's what we're going to talk about now, the stars in the sky. That doesn't really matter, quite frankly, when we're talking about bodily autonomy and the violation of someone's bodily autonomy, or the fear that people had going home at night to their dormitories, and I felt should have taken precedence. And so amplifying that narrative and overcoming the idea of like, what do you mean sexual assault happens here? It doesn't happen here, with actual narratives from people, survivors on campus, to come into direct conflict or, contradict that statement in a real way was probably the highlight of my time at Middlebury. To know that the blue lights went up and still weren't as many as we wanted, but it felt like a win and a small win. And yeah, I don't know if I directly answered that question. It felt like very much we were in our own little world at Middlebury. The parallels to perhaps a similar revolution that was happening outside, I can say that I think we acted in solidarity with the general movement against sexual assault on campuses and made this a priority.
Do you feel like people were actively thinking about and fighting against sexual assault in kind of the activist circles that you ran in, or do you feel like it was kind of a wider campus awareness that this was a problem?
I think that's an interesting question. I think that it was everyone knew it was a problem for sure. I think that there were more people willing to participate in the conversation about it than others. And for example, like if you were a frat guy, like, in the social houses, I don't want to be, it's very stereotypical, but it's also kind of true. It's a stereotype because, there were these people who were affiliated with the social houses who you would never see at a Feminist Action at Middlebury thing. But then there were people who were part of the social houses who were allies who were in Feminist Action at Middlebury and, women and men alike. So it did, I feel like, cross over a lot of different associations. So, like women of color, the organization, they joined sort of forces with us on a lot of different things. I think that for me, I wanted to bridge the gap between different organizations and also different people in different groups. And I found that that was probably the hardest thing. And I'm trying to think of, I guess, the I Love My Body fashion show that we did, which was so much fun. And we joined with a bunch of different organizations, and the diversity of people who showed up there was fascinating. I thought that was fascinating. You had like football players, people from the basketball, like, all of these different circles of people coming to speak and hear about sexual assault, about confidence, about the female body and how we own it and how it's been appropriated. And I thought that that signaled to me that people, if they weren't aware, wanted to be aware. And then there were people who were not part of it. And that, I think, intersected with privilege, like people who are privileged to not ever have to think about sexual assault or perhaps perpetrate it. Those people never showed up, I would say. It's just my own, what I think might be the case there about the people who weren't part of it.
You said that by the time you were a sophomore that you wanted to kind of involve yourself more in the feminist organizations or kind of like rejuvenate them on campus. Were you seeing problems that kind of prompted you to act on campus, or you just knew that was kind of where you wanted to go?
It was a lot of conversations I was having with the women on campus. I also was severely, like, dealing with a pretty severe eating disorder on campus, and had, you know, my own personal struggles. And I was also part of the Posse Foundation. So I had like a group of people who, you know, supported me all the time while I was on campus, personally and otherwise. Really just wanted to create a space for people to feel safe, whatever that might be. And because I didn't feel like I had it necessarily, like I had my crew and I had the people I could call to just cry to when I was having a bad day, or, you know, come to therapy with me because I didn't want to go talk about my feelings anymore, or whatever it might be. And I just felt like, how many people are struggling, you know, like how many people need a space to talk in. And so we did that in Chella's house, and it was really beautiful. I have to say, those were my happiest times, just sitting in there, you know, writing my thesis with my best friend there and just watching people come in and come together, and knowing that there would be, I would be there, that my friend Asia would be there, and that we would be like welcoming people with open arms, whoever they were, and would in whatever sort of trauma they were experiencing with them. And yeah, so I would say that it was personal, and which, you know, a lot of movements sometimes start as a personal one, and then it became something bigger, and it was really beautiful. I mean, I was just talking to Asia. She's fantastic, super brilliant. And we were sort of partners in crime, you know, and we would speak, we made a bunch of like films while we were at Middlebury together. And we really tried to just be the voice for people who couldn't or didn't want to be. And we supported people. And that was, we were just talking on the phone. She lives in Paris now. Mm-hmm. And we always think about Middlebury. We always think about that time that we had together being creative in activism. And we still share that bond together, and still try to do that in our own lives, however different they may be now.
I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about your experience of the feminist organizing. You said that you were you were the president, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you said that you kind of got together with some friends and decided that you guys wanted to kind of, was it start FAM, or was it like rejuvenate it? Was FAM pre-existing?
It had existed. And then I don't know, it just felt like a dead in the water like thing that was happening. It wasn't, there weren't like a lot of events. It wasn't in your face. And so I just remember speaking with Karin about it. And Hanta, and being like, what is, like, where is this group? It just didn't feel like it was happening as much as I felt it should. And then we just sort of took it over and went with it.
Mm-hmm. And so when you guys kind of revitalized it, it was you leading it and anyone else?
Me, there was Asia. There are different people that are coming to my mind, like Morgan Richardson and Trinity, Gaddy, just all of my friends, Darcelle Williams, all of my friends who sort of just rallied around it. Women of Color, the Women of Color group was also being run simultaneously. I'm forgetting names of everyone. I just sort of remember that we were trying to work in tandem as much as possible too. Yeah.
How was the gender distribution of FAM?
Lots of women. Mostly women. There were a few men who would come and participate. I would say like two to three consistently. But really, it was just mostly women.
Do you remember how big the group was?
It would vary depending on people's lives and schedules at the time, but typically we'd have like between 15 to 20 people, I would say, and then our events were well attended, I would say.
And what kinds of events did you have?
So we did like a few protests where we protested social house, what we felt was rape culture, things that were happening in the social house that we didn't agree, that were just terrible.
What did the protests look like?
We got together, made a bunch of posters, like 100% of protests, like we were in the streets of New York City. And yeah, marched through the social houses with our, I just remember, I have pictures somewhere of it. Oh, I wish I could find them. But it was all of us just marching through with our picket signs and chanting. I can't remember any of the chants, so don't ask me that. But it was great. I remember there being like a very significant number of people actually part of it, 30 to 40 people. It was so much fun, unless I'm just inflating that number in my head, but it felt like 30 to 40 people. Then of course, the I Love My Body fashion show. We did Love Fest, where, you know, we partnered with other organizations similar to, it was like a speak out. We did another, I don't know that we would necessarily call it a protest, but we did do a speak out during one of the dance events that was happening on campus, things like that. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about Love Fest and also who started it. Was that something that you guys came up with?
Yeah, it's something we came up with, and it was, I still have some of the stickers from it, actually. Yeah, we definitely started it. And gosh, Love Fest. It was, I remember it was on the steps of, what's that?
Mead Chapel?
Mead Chapel, yeah. We were on like the steps of Mead Chapel. People were sharing stories, doing spoken word. I remember that singing. It was really beautiful. Like, we had such a wonderful time putting that together and organizing it. And then it being like so well attended was really inspiring and fun and liberating. Yeah, we did invent that. I wish I could find some of the stickers and send them to you. I still have saved them. I even think I have, if I really search, I have like the planning documents for that. But it was a lot of fun to put together. We wanted people to feel connected and fun and inspired and free. You know, like, I feel like we were born in the wrong decade. Like, we were the bra burning, you know, feminist free for alling of people that we wanted, and we wanted that feel again. Like, that's what we wanted to exist at Middlebury. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we did Love Fest. Mm-hmm. It was so much fun.
That's super cool. You have mentioned the Love Your Body fashion show a few times, and I was wondering if you could just describe it a little bit more so we get a better idea of what it is.
We all made t-shirts that said on the front, like, I love my body because, and then on the back, it was whatever word you had to describe your body. And so it was very personal, and it was, you know, women and men too, who were dealing with eating disorders, raising awareness about disordered eating and eating disorders, and also just embracing like an empowering narrative around bodies, especially female bodies that are sort of and still ravaged by, you know, this public ideal of what a woman should look like, how a woman should carry herself, what a woman should wear. I mean, you know, these are still the things when Hillary Clinton's running for, you know, president, and Elizabeth Warren is running for president. We don't talk about the substance of what they say, but the outside appearance of looking aged and, you know, it's ridiculous. It's absurd. And so we were trying to just deal with that in whatever way that we could then, to feel empowered in our own skin and to really talk about how important it is to be kind. Like it's always so basic, right? It's like, just be kind to people and to recognize that everyone is sort of going through a struggle. And so why are we dehumanizing people in this way that's so superficial? So yeah, that's what we did. And it was so fun. Ugh, I wish those, I think maybe it's recorded, but I just remember it being really beautiful. And like my friend April sang a song that was just gorgeous. And it was this roundup of people who just wanted to empower other people and change a narrative around bodies. And it was really well done, I thought. And just, yeah, it was great.
And do you remember what years you did that fashion show?
We did it my junior, I think we did it both years, junior and senior year.
That was like 2003, or 2005 and 2006.
Yeah.
In terms of the blue light activism that you guys did, what form the blue light activism took and like how long that took you guys to get done and what it looked like?
It came up in a meet, like one of our fam meetings, it came up and someone was like, I feel like the New Yorkers spoke up about it, because like people who lived in cities were like, Middlebury's creepy at night, like there are no lights, and like you, as I always felt safer around noise and lights. That's like the life you grow up in when you grow up in the city, and like in Middlebury, that's not what it is, right? It's like country, it's the country. Wow. So, and it's beautiful and idyllic and all of those things, but it's a little bit creepy too. Mm-hmm. Or can be. So I just remember it coming up like that, and then we were doing research on blue lights and finding out if there were any federal rules or, you know, things about how many blue lights each campus needs and what are some of the regulations around it. And then we just sort of advocated for it. I know that there was this committee started, and Sujata Murthy was, I think it was either her first or second year. I love her. She's the best. And we were on a committee together, and I believe it was a diversity, something about diversity and inclusion.
Equity and inclusion.
Yeah. Does that still exist? That still exists? Oh, wow. And I feel like it came up in one of those meetings too. There was like something about safety planning at Middlebury, things like that. And I met with President Leibowitz one-on-one. Essentially, I got like all of this research together. We did a petition. Everyone signed it. We got as many people to sign it as possible that we wanted blue lights on campus and why it was a necessity. And then I met with him one-on-one and sort of pitched it to him. And at the time, oh my God, what was his name? His secondhand man, Tim. I can't remember his last name right now. Sujata would know, and so would Karen. So I basically just made my pitch, and I was like, listen, this is something that we need for safety. You see it on every college campus. I forget how many feet apart they're supposed to be. You're supposed to be able to be standing at one and see the next one. That's the whole point of it. And you know, there might be not that many reports of sexual assaults on campus, but there aren't a lot of reports of that. All the reporting on sexual assault is pretty low compared to what the actual number is. But there are also people who are experiencing different kinds of fears around this. So it's like, are we going to address this as a campus and make a statement that we care about how people feel and how they perceive their safety? Even if it's just symbolic to all of you, it's an actual prevention mechanism for every kind of crime. So I just remember there being a few, and that like sort of spurred our protest. We had a protest. I remember that the feedback that we had gotten was that there was a concern of light pollution from the local neighborhood, people who lived in the neighborhood, they didn't want to be affected by it. And I'm like, what are you talking? I just felt like that was so insane, you know, and everyone sort of was like, oh, okay. So it doesn't matter if someone gets raped as long as you can see the stars, you know? So that's cool, except it's not. So, so we did a march around the president's building. And it was a really significant number of people because we were able to totally encircle it and we marched. And that's when his number two person, Tim, comes outside and starts engaging the crowd. And he was like, you know, I'll take the time to listen to everyone. And people were like speaking out. And he finally said, I don't understand the problem because sexual assault doesn't happen here in the way that you guys are saying it does, which then spurred survivors who were so brave, I thought, to do this in front of people that maybe they didn't even know, hadn't interacted with, and then him, like at some administrator at Middlebury, starting to say, like, I was raped here. I was raped here. And it became, it was sort of deafening to me that there it is. There are the statistics, 1 in 3, 1 in 4, whatever it is now. At the time, I believe it was 1 in 4 women were going to be the victim or survivor of some sort of sexual violence in their lives. And it was, I just remember being like moved to tears by it and being like, fuck you. Like, you know, how dare you say something like that when we all, like, have you read the news? We all know this is true and that it's happening in one way or another. And it's your responsibility to know and to protect people, or at least try to help protect people, or let them define for themselves what it means to feel protected and be protected. So that was a huge thing. And then we saw blue lights go up and it became a real conversation. And even when I go back to Middlebury, I went last year, I guess, and I saw the blue lights and it made me so happy because I felt like that was everyone. That wasn't me, it wasn't Asya, it was everyone who came together to sort of demonize the narrative of this doesn't happen here. It happens everywhere. That's just ignorance. You know, if you don't want to know that it happens here, that's one thing, but don't tell us it doesn't, when clearly these are human beings with stories of violence, of sexual violence. So that's what that sort of looked like. And it was beautiful. I loved it.
Sounds incredible.
Yeah.
Very brave people. You said you went and kind of sat down with the president. Was there a health and wellness office or Title IX coordinator? Or, because often I think these days when we have something, we bring it to them. We don't bring it like directly to the president, and it gets handled through other channels. So there was no other like an administrator figure that you would go to?
Oh, there probably were, but I... I mean, there were people like Karen Gutentag. She was part of, I believe at the time, like the judicial committee of blah, blah, blah. I don't know what they called themselves. They called that judicial committee on student misconduct, right? Or something like that. It was like their own judicial system. But I didn't know of anyone else who existed on campus who I would go to talk to about this, or at the time at least. Mm-hmm. Or I was just being brazen and yeah, I just felt like, you know, why not talk to him about this? I feel like President Leibowitz was vocal at the time as like someone who had like an open door policy in a way, and like, you know, so I just figured, why not just meet with him and talk with him about this? And then you can't say that you didn't know. It's like, I don't know how it would filter up to him or how the message would be delivered, but to have like a voice who has personally interacted with people with specific experiences and concerns, I would just talk with him. He was in charge. So yeah, that's what I did.
In terms of your activism against sexual assault with fam, you've mentioned the Love Fest and the blue light stuff. Was there anything else big that you wanted to mention?
Those were the events that really stuck out in my head. Of course, we had like a bunch of different smaller things, or we joined forces. We did like a lot. We invited like Stacey Ann Chen to come do spoken word, Alex Olson, all of these awesome kick-ass feminists. We won like the first, we did the first, I can't believe I forgot this, the first Women's and Gender Studies Symposium. I guess they get like, we got funding for it. So they would choose like certain groups to run a week-long symposium at Middlebury. I don't know if they still do this. They do. It was awesome. And we had all of these awesome spoken word poets come. We held talks, we showed films. Yeah. And we were so proud of it because I think it was the first time that feminism had been so widely talked about on campus. And yeah, and I can say with certainty that every single event was really, really attended, you know, it was like, and it was almost surprising, but also just made us feel like we were doing something important and like people were ready to have these kinds of conversations and these deliberative dialogues about gender. And it was awesome. I remember that being a big win. I can't believe I almost forgot to bring it up. Yeah. And Asya would be able to tell you more, I'm sure. She has a sharper memory at this point. Maybe not. I don't know. It's been so long, but yeah, that was awesome.
Was there anything else you wanted to talk about regarding fam or your activism with fam?
No, I still look back on that time and recognize that it was probably the most important time in my life. I mean, I learned how to use my voice. I learned about bringing people together. I learned about leadership. And it was an intellectual time. It was and felt like I was going to change the world. And with these wonderful human beings that I got the privilege of meeting and still being friends with in my life. And that we were able to leave something behind in the form of blue lights. I was able to be the graduation speaker that year and of graduation, and used it as yet one last platform to talk about blue lights and being part of a movement. And that, you know, as we're leaving Middlebury, that we need to carry what we've learned here, the lessons of whatever we were part of or not part of into the world with us, and to affect it in some way positively and to change it. And I think that that part of me, it was really formed at Middlebury. Sujata Murthy, Karen Hanta, like these two women were so magnanimous to me. And when I was writing my thesis, Sujata, when anytime I had an idea, I want to do a class on necrophilia and sexual assault and see if there's any like overlap between the two psychologically. And she's like, okay, let's do this. And so Asya and I just came up with this curriculum, and we did it, and we were able to go to Algeria and film a documentary on, you know, on women who were being essentially marginalized and put into these facilities. These shelters were rendered helpless and homeless because they weren't virgins on the night of their wedding. And like, I got to see the world, and I got to create and organize and protest. And that was the most important time of my life. And it guided what I did after Middlebury, and it still guides what I do today. So, yeah.
Were you part of any other organizations that you wanted to mention besides FAM or any other activism?
I was in the cheerleading team, which was
How was that for you?
you should read the article I wrote, Cheer, Cheer for Feminism. it's in the archives. I actually saw that. Yeah, that was like a fun, it was just fun. I never pictured myself as a cheerleader. I'm not some, that typical quote unquote, this quintessential cheerleader that you read and see about. But that's why it was so cool. No one on the team was, and we were just having fun. And I remember we went to a competition. It was the competitive cheer team. So we went to a competition, and on the way back, we were going by a Hooters, and we got out of the van and protested in front of Hooters in full uniform. It was hilarious. And yeah, I mean, like everything sort of revolved around feminist action at Middlebury for me. There was nothing I was part of that was as that even came closer compared to that level of commitment I had to that group.
You mentioned Chellis House a few times. What role did Chellis House have in like campus culture at that time?
Well, for me, it was my home. Like, that was my second home. And Asya and I would go in there and light fires, use the fireplace and hold like a peaceful place. And I think that it was our stomping grounds. It was like our second home. And that's where you could find us if we weren't out on campus doing something or in our dorm rooms studying or whatever. We would study in there too. So yeah, I think Chella's house was our heaven. Like, it was just a safe place to go. And I feel like everyone who was part of FAM and who knew about Chella's house used it in the same way. So it always felt like if we were going there, we were going to be seeing people l who were like-minded and wanted to be part of, bringing feminism into the conversation at every turn possible and really just supported each other. Yeah, I think that the role it played was a safe space for people who felt marginalized or just wanted a place to feel safe.
How did your classwork contribute to like your feminist education or activism, or did it?
I mean, sure. I think you can't have any sort of knowledge without, I mean, any sort of power that's real, without knowledge. And so every single class I took, contributed in some way, shape, or form to the kind of activism I would participate in, and recognizing that what I find as freedom as a white woman is different from what my friends who are black or brown were experiencing, or what they deemed to be the right approach to their feminism was different. And and a lot of the work that I do now, I mean, I was a public defender for some time, and now I'm still a lawyer, but I run a courthouse and programming, and you see intersectionality in everywhere you turn, right? The intersectional oppressions that happen, and having the words for that to think about, the birdcage and what that means for a person who's inside of it. Like, that analogy always stayed with me, and there were and I still like my bookcase is just filled with all of my books from Middlebury, and I still turn back to them, and all of the things that I learned have played a role in my activism for sure. And the professors I had were just incredible. I mean, I was able to also have the freedom to come up with my own classes that really were geared towards what I wanted to learn. And I think writing my thesis was also, I think everyone should write a thesis. It was a really powerful time of my life in terms of knowledge gaining. I spent so much time researching and having intellectual conversations with Sujata and Asya, and traveling and doing the supplementary documentary work for the thesis and then presenting it. I mean, all of the things that I did academically certainly empowered me as an activist for sure.
Did do you feel like your, or how did you feel like your work was received by students and by administration?
My work, academic work?
And activist work.
Ah, people respected me. And I think that because of that, they understood my what I was doing. They understood, and I think that for the most part, I felt supported by the administration. Now, maybe that's because it's not like we were doing anything violent, you know, we were speaking about basic things that were sort of being taken for granted, like the right to bodily autonomy, the right to a fucking blue light. Like, why would anyone come down on me for that? I think there were people who just didn't care, and that's fine. It wasn't their thing. It wasn't their fight. They were, you know, doing whatever sport they were doing or running or, you know, whatever, and they didn't want to be part of that, and that's fine. But I never felt like I was demonized or branded in some negative light or way because of the work that we were doing in FAM. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any specific mentors or allies that you hadn't mentioned with your activist work?
There were so many. Anne Hansen. I was part of the Posse Foundation, the Posse group that came in. So I felt really supported by everyone in my posse. We had Roman, who is just the best, so funny. He was very inspiring to me and also an ally. Obviously, Sujata, Karen, hands down. I'm forgetting someone, I'm sure of it. But yeah, I would say those were predominantly the people that I really connected with the most and who were certainly there for me through a lot. Karen Gutentag was also very part of Posse and certainly encouraged my activism on campus. And I think she even attended some events. Everyone really did. And it was because it wasn't just a message. It was also a lot of fun, and everyone could relate to everything that we were talking about in some way, shape, or form. So yeah, I would say those were my primary mentors and people who I really felt connected with.
We've been asking people what they felt the best part of their experience of activism was and what they felt like the worst part was.
The best part was actually having an impact and seeing something resulting from our work, you know, most notably the blue lights, was a huge win for us. And also just successfully creating a safe space for people. That was definitely the best part of our activism and feeling empowered and connected. Mm-hmm. And then the downfall was maybe that it's a lot of work, you know? It was sort of exhausting in a lot of ways because you always have to be ready for the fight. And because that's what I wanted. So that's what I did. But it was still tiring. It was still exhausting. It was still like, sometimes when you're leading something, you don't get to be someone who, like, falls apart a little bit, you know? But luckily I did have Asia and my personal posse to support me when that was happening. But I think that's the hardest part of anything you care about, is that it's a lot of work and you have to get up every day and live your message, however that might look.
Did you feel like you saw change over the time that you were at Middlebury?
I saw a change in myself. And so, yeah, I mean, and even with my classmates, it's kind of, I felt like we all grew up together in a way. And there were always going to be the people I was like, you're never going to be in my crew, but I'm sure people felt the same way about me. But like, I felt like the more confident people became about their connections and their own personal beliefs, the more they would show up at events and like be connected to our group and our messaging and engaging in deliberative dialogues. I think we did that too, deliberative dialogues, where we would like invite people from different groups on campus to come sit down and have a conversation about feminism and like what it means. And so Yeah, I felt like by the time I was giving our graduation speech that more people knew me, that, you know, even people who I would never necessarily be friends with today or back then. But we all sort of respected our roles, and that was a nice thing to see. And also everyone just grew into their fight, you know, like whatever it was that someone was standing up for or standing against, it was more pronounced by the end, by year four. And no one, and by then you're just like, I don't care. And now you're like in your late 30s and you're like, I really don't care. Like, I'll say whatever I want. And so I can't imagine what the rest of my life will look like. But yeah. And so I think that's what I saw. I saw people growing into their messaging and getting stronger in what they wanted and who they were. And that was really nice in different ways.
What did you wish that you had known about organizing before, or what advice would you give to activists now at Middlebury?
To reach outside of your circle more, I think that's always the hardest part of like, how do you get people who won't engage in this conversation or in this fight? How do you get them on your side? How do you cross the line and bring them over it? And sometimes you won't be able to, and other times you might be able to change someone's perspective a little bit. So I think that just getting outside and figuring out like how to talk to people who aren't necessarily on your side. Yeah.
You've mentioned that your feminist activism at Middlebury has kind of like informed what you've done with your life since Middlebury. What have you done since leaving?
I went to Goldman Sachs for right after I graduated, and that was because I mean, I honestly never thought I would ever work at a place like that, but I knew I wanted to go into the field of law, and I didn't really necessarily know what that would mean. Like, did I want to go work at the United Nations? Did I want to do this? But I felt like this would be a good time to go fuck up some heteronormative shit while I still could. So I went to Goldman Sachs with all of the people from Middlebury that I didn't want to be around. No, I'm kidding. But it was the place where I interacted with people who are in like the 1% kind of, you know, like the who didn't talk about feminism, who didn't like, you know, it was like the social house crew of the campus, you know. Like they were in frats and sororities and going to Wharton Business School. And I had like no way in my head was I ever gonna do any of this crap. And, you know, one bet later, and I'm working at Goldman Sachs on like, I remember my internship was on the floor of the stock exchange. And I remember there being like all of these men. There was literally one woman who was a trader there that I could see. And I remember every day they'd be like, oh, Lauren, like you can't go get the lunches downstairs because you're a woman. So you just like stay here and talk to us. And I was like, so I would in my heels, like go downstairs, wait for the guy to deliver the lunch and bring them upstairs and like dump it on the desk. Like, here, I can actually do this just because I'm a woman doesn't mean. And it was the first time I was really engaging people in feminism that were in a completely different world, you know, and like we would talk about it. We talked about my major at Middlebury, women's and gender studies, and like what it meant. And it was a huge focal point of my interview at Goldman, actually, is like, was about women in economics. And, you know, and if we gave microfinancing to women in sub-Saharan Africa, like, and let them build their own businesses, what would that look like? How would that change the economy, stimulate the economy, give people autonomy, especially women? And I connected with a woman named Susie Scher, who is now, I think, like running Goldman Sachs, essentially. She's brilliant. Was on the board of the Posse Foundation. And I just kept admiring her as a woman being in this business as a leader and what that must have taken for her to do, because there were so many microaggressions there. Like, it was a boys club, like an actual boys club. And I remember being, when I got hired out of my internship class, and thinking about like, is this really the smartest decision I can make? And thinking like, why not go have an impact in a world that is super heteronormative and outside of what I would ever be in? And, you know, I can save for law school and et cetera, et cetera. And what an awesome experience it was. I mean, I used to send out like feminist haikus to our floor, and I had conversations with people at hedge funds that I would never have talked to about just sexual, sexual discrimination. And I was sexually harassed multiple times. I mean, like, and then it really puts your activism to work, and you're like, how do I stand up for myself? And how does that translate into standing up for all the women who are in this position at this company and in any company, really? So, and I found my female mentors there who are still to this day my very good friends. And I learned so much. I learned even more perhaps about one's voice and how important it is in the world. And then I left and I went to law school. I spent 3 years there. I said, like, I'm going to do my contract with Goldman, but essentially I wanted to go to law school. And then the stock market crashed, which I swear I had nothing to do with it. I bounced and I went to law school, and I wanted to do public interest work. I interned with the United Nations, and then it wasn't really what I wanted. I was working a lot in my third year of law school. I was in the International Women's Human Rights Clinic. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing vacature motions for women who had been trafficked in New York and were getting arrested and charged with prostitution related charges. And so we were working on getting those people's criminals' records vacated, which was really inspiring work, again, directly because of my feminist activist work at Middlebury. It became my mission, my life, my purpose. And so everywhere I have gone since then has been really, it draws from that experience at Middlebury. So yeah, I did that. And then I took sort of a year, I took the bar exam and luckily passed the bar exam, and then just figured things out for a year. And I worked in housing court. I worked with Legal Aid Society doing more of the vacature motions. I was doing some independent work with another women's organization and trying to figure out where is my voice best going to be used in this world, the legal world. And so finally I decided, like, I need to be at Legal Aid. I need to be representing the most marginalized people in our society. And I can't think of a more marginalized group of people than people who are in the criminal justice system. And so I went to Legal Aid Society and worked at in the criminal defense division for about 5 years. And now I am the director of Midtown Community Court in Midtown Manhattan. And we work on coming up with innovative programming for alternatives to incarceration, reentry. And it's really creative work and exciting work. And yeah, I don't know what's next, but certainly all of the things I've done since Middlebury has been shaped by that experience. And I miss litigation, I will say that, but everywhere I turn, I do feel like I'm part of representing the disenfranchised and the marginalized. And because of my academic experience at Middlebury, I recognize my whiteness in that, and, you know, the things that can be isolating for the people with whom I work that I can't help. And so owning that about me, owning my whiteness, owning my femaleness, my privileges as a white woman, has really furthered my work with my clients and with the people that I interact with generally. So yeah.
Was there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, I think this is such a cool thing that you're doing. And I'm really happy that there's going to be a sort of oral account of everything. And I hope I didn't say anything that would preclude me from running for office, but
wonderful. Thank all of you guys for the work you did that still gets to support and affect us in such a positive way in our time at Middlebury. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was so fun walking down memory lane. So thank you.